I'm Evan Kleinman, and this is Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. Ever had a whoopie pie? It's a pile of frosting stuffed between two soft cookies. Get ready. The massive farm bill has more to do with what we eat and how we live in this country than any other piece of legislation. I'll tell you how it affects your life. A recipe for edible tree branches today, plus a response from a winemaker to some misinformation on last week's show on additives in wine. First, let's see what's in season at the Santa Monica Farmers Market.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. We're visiting with Mary Ann Carpenter, who is a grower from Santa Paula, and she and her son Mark come to the market every week, and they are famous for their carrots, their turnips, their beets, all their veggies, and of course in the summer, Mary Ann leads the charge with all the field heirloom tomatoes. So we're in that little space now before summer, and your table is loaded with gorgeous root crops. Let's talk about some of those.
The one item we're most excited about is the baby turnips. We've got some pale pink turnips and some baby yellow turnips that are just amazing. The pink ones are, I think, the sweetest and best tasting turnip I've ever had.
Is the flesh pink as well?
Well, the flesh is white. The skin is pink, but the flesh is white, flecked with a light pink fleck inside. They're just really juicy and sweet. We have a great recipe. I don't know if you're in the mood cook some turnips, but really I just braise them. I peel them and chop them in a small chop, braise them in a little bit of salted water, and then once they're tender, which takes just a few minutes, drain them and add a little bit of butter, and this is a secret, a little bit of honey, just a little, you know, a little squirt or two, maybe a half a tablespoon of honey, or maybe not even that much, depending on how many turnips you've cooked, and a little salt and pepper, and it is amazing.
And what do you do with the greens? Those are wonderful, too.
Well, I personally don't cook the greens, but a lot of people do. They love them. It's kind of a southern thing. They add them to some of the other greens that we have, like collard greens and cavallo nero. But I've just never cooked the turnip greens. I'm just wild about the turnips.
Okay, and let's try to describe what turnips taste like.
I think people are used to a real strong-tasting vegetable when they think of turnips. The old-fashioned white turnips that we're all kind of used to were kind of strong. These new varieties are a little bit milder, and maybe I would compare it to jicama. It has a little more flavor than jicama, but it's, you know, a crunchy, kind of a sweet vegetable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they are. They're really good and more complex, too.
Yes. And you can also roast them. They're so good roasted. But I really wish people would try this braising with just a little bit of honey. One of the chefs gave me this recipe, and I'm telling you, I think we've eaten more turnips this winter than we ever have.
Well, thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
That was Mary Ann Carpenter. She's a vegetable grower from Santa Paula, and her table is just loaded every week with gorgeous, just vibrant greens and roots. Always worth checking out. We're visiting now with Alex Weiser of Weiser Family Farms. They're every week at the Wednesday, Saturday, and all the Santa Monica farmers markets, plus several other markets in the Southland. And you always have, well, you're famous for your potatoes, but you're constantly bringing in new stuff. So tell us what's on the table right now.
Well, it is spring, so we have our seasonal crops coming in. And with spring, we have, we just started today with spring garlic, green garlic. We have spring red onions that are, it's a scallion right now. Eventually there'll be a spring onion as they get bigger.
And this is the one, it hasn't formed its bulb yet. It looks like a scallion, but you can eat the entire thing.
You can
chop up the tops and use the bottom.
It's very delicious. And it kind of has a shallotty taste. Mm. But what's nice is that these are the same onions that will be our red onions in the fall. So we sell at every stage that way. We always overplant. And then what's coming soon is Bloomsdale spinach. We picked a little bit today just to start. That's that heavily Savoyed variety.
Very ruffly.
Yeah, that's sweet.
Yeah.
Doesn't have that tannin aftertaste.
Right, doesn't make your teeth feel gritty, right?
And then our spring potatoes will be coming in shortly. Actually, we'll be starting in a day or two. They should be ready. Our French fingerlings, red thumb fingerlings, Russian banana, Austrian crescents, and then in a couple weeks we'll have purples. So one variety after another is coming in, and I have to mention German butterballs. We planted much more this year because people ran back for those. Those have such a great taste.
Those are so good, and those are so great baked as well.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And then we have a new one this year, a French variety called Desiree. that's a red skin potato and yellow flesh, a light yellow flesh. And it's a great all-purpose potato that's very popular in Europe.
Can we talk a little bit about, quote, new potatoes, the ones?
Sure.
And you bring those in.
Some people think a new potato is just a red, small red potato. But a new potato is any size potato that just has a tender skin on them, that where the skin is kind of flaking. And when you dig them early, we usually try to set a good skin on them because we dig them mechanically with a digger. And when the skins are too tender, they get banged up. They don't look so well. And when they don't have that skin set, they don't store as well. So at the beginning of every new season, they're new. So this new crop will have a flakier skin on them, especially the Russian bananas. So we just dig them as we need them. On the reds, though, we try to develop a better skin on them because people just don't like to see reds that aren't fully red.
Okay, and you can tell a new potato, the skin hasn't set, it's a little flakier. And is there a difference in the flavor?
There is, but they're different. Sometimes potatoes taste better after they've been stored for a while. Right now I have these sunbursts that are 3 or 4 months old, but chefs love them because they're dry and they soak up a lot of the fats and juices.
Oh.
So it's funny that they want these uglier potatoes sometimes.
Who knew that a drier potato would soak up more flavor and be a better one to cook with? That's so interesting. All right, Alex, and we're looking forward to summer and all your new changing. We'll visit with you often and frequently. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
That was Alex Weiser from Weiser Family Farms. They farm up in Tehachapi and also out in the Lucerne Valley year-round at all 4 Santa Monica farmers markets and other markets in the L.A. County area. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
Speaking of farmers, there's one piece of legislation that has more impact on the way we live than any other. It's the Farm Bill. Every 5 years or so, Congress debates and passes this bill. The Farm Bill has everything to do with snack foods, school lunches, how crops are grown, and which crops are grown. I'll be back with a look at this bill and tell you about a book that tries to explain through pictures. That's next on Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. Words Farm Bill and watch eyes roll back into heads in preemptive boredom. Very wrong behavior, bad behavior. In seeding knowledge about the Farm Bill, you're giving up the only true control you have over what you eat. Forget all that sauce on the side stuff. Exercise control by learning. Who determines which foods get to the grocery store shelves? Which foods are grown by American farmers and why? Dan Imhoff is here to answer some of these questions. His book on the Farm Bill is Food Fight, The Citizen's Guide to a Food and Farm Bill. I'm guessing that most Americans don't know there's a National Farm Bill, and they probably don't know that it comes up for review every 5 years. So if we could start with a little discussion of the bill, how did it come to be?
The Farm Bill, its origins are really in the Great Depression and the Dust Bowl. And you can probably imagine, the average person can imagine, bread lines and soup kitchens and soil literally blowing away from the fields. And it was a time when the whole world, its economy was changing, I think, from an agrarian to a very industrial and urbanized economy. And it became clear to a number of policymakers inside Washington that without government intervention, there was going to be collapse and maybe even revolution. There were so many farm foreclosures and so many hungry, and yet so much food, and everything was completely out of balance.
Do you really feel like this original Farm Bill has sort of sculpted the nature of agriculture in America?
Well, the Farm Bill is this massive economic engine, and it just sets so many different things in motion. And I think many people kind of feel like it supports family farmers, or, you know, it's really about conservation programs or something like that, and it doesn't have anything to do with them. And actually, a farm bill is directly related to what crops we grow, where, how much of them, what our food costs, what it tastes like, what its nutritional contents are, and what farming's impact on our land and our people really are.
Let's talk for a minute about subsidies. What are the big cash crops that are subsidized, and how do these subsidies actually work to affect obesity?
Well, of all the hundreds of crops that we depend on in our diet, or we should for a diverse and healthy, nutritious diet, the Farm Bill mainly subsidizes five crops: cotton, corn, wheat, rice, and soybeans. These subsidies increasingly go to a very small percentage of the largest farmers. Most American farmers who are outside of those commodity crops don't get any support at all. And, you know, if there's any doubt that these farm subsidies have anything to do with our diet, you just walk down the supermarket aisle. All these crops enter our diet indirectly through high fructose corn syrup and fats and oils and other processed ingredients. They're just so much cheaper to buy on a pound-per-pound basis than fresh fruits, fresh vegetables. In fact, the whole kind of wholesome diet that the USDA food pyramid recommends. So what we have is a subsidy system that supports industrial food ingredients and then delivers us calories, but not a nutritional diet.
Why are we supporting these particular crops, which seem like by now their nature has been so mined for profitability that they don't need to be supported anymore?
First of all, a lot of these subsidized crops go for cheap feed and cheap livestock and dairy production in these huge, huge, massive confinement farms. And the benefits flow directly there. And then there's the international grain trade. And these people are extremely powerful. They're putting, you know, $100 million in lobbying monies into Washington every single year, not just every single farm bill negotiation cycle. Part of it also, though, goes back to those very early farm bills where the government got into storing commodities, you know, distributing them in times of need. And so fresh fruits and vegetables and things that are really nutritious for us weren't really part of those early bills.
One of the things that I found most fascinating in your book is that you follow this really cheap grain that our farmers are able to produce because they're subsidized, and you talk a lot about the effect that they have all over the world. Right now, illegal immigration is so foremost in sort of the national conversation. What's the link between this grain trade and illegal immigration coming up from Mexico and Central America?
It's pretty well documented. 10 years, more than 10 years now, of NAFTA and then these increasingly subsidized corn harvests have sent cheap corn, cheaper than it cost our farmers to grow it, down to Mexico. And as a result, almost 1.5 million Mexican farmers are estimated to have been forced off their lands. They were either traditional corn or sugarcane producers. They're being forced north to the maquiladoras, to the cities, up into our country to hopefully find some work, and then they can send money home so their families down there can buy our cheap subsidized corn.
It just seems like such a totally backward situation. Towards the end of the book, you have a section sort of where do we go from here. Could you give us just a couple of those ideas so we don't feel so hopeless?
Sure. You know, I mean, so many of the ideas and the models of a better system are out there. I think aligning our crop subsidies with our nutritional guidelines is a no-brainer. I mean, let's start to make the nutritious much more affordable rather than just the high calorie. And then another thing that is extremely important to me is let's grow less corn and a lot more grass. Let's figure out programs where we can get corn farmers transitioning into grass-pastured meat and dairy products, and you will find that you'll have healthier foods, and the benefits will flow from there.
Dan, thank you so much.
Thanks a lot.
Dan Imhoff is the author of Food Fight, The Citizen's Guide to a Food and Farm Bill. It's a really unique way to look at some complex and potentially boring reading. fluffy, thick frosting stuffed between a pair of cookies isn't boring at all. I'm talking about a whoopie pie. If you're a native Californian, you have no idea what I'm talking about. I'll clue you in next when Good Food returns. Health and diet seem to be on most people's minds these days. But you know, there's moments when you just want to sink your teeth into a bit of sweet, soft, fluffy goodness. Moments when you want to have a treat. And there are a lot of purveyors out there to satisfy our cravings. We recently heard about Amy Bouchard and her wicked whoopie pies. Could you describe what a whoopie pie is?
Sure. It's two round pieces of cake, which are shaped like a cookie. And the classic whoopie pie is like a dark chocolate devil's food cake with fluffy vanilla cream filling. And of course, we make them in all different flavors because we want to make everybody wicked happy.
Now, is this a regional specialty from where you hail from?
Yes, it's definitely really popular in New England, but of course we're trying to change all that.
Were they ever like an industrialized product where you saw them in every sort of convenience store and then you decided to make a homemade version, or have they always kind of been a homemade kind of thing?
Well, they always were a homemade thing. It was one of those things where when I was little, like my grandmother would make them, my mom would make them. And the thing with the whoopie pie is really they always had a reputation of being dry, and you kind of had to drink a gallon of milk to choke them down. And so, and when I was a little kid, that was fine. I mean, the filling was really heavy and sugary, and the cake was a little dry, but I didn't care. I mean, it was just loaded with sugar, and it was just good. But as I got older, I really like a nice moist cake, and I don't really like a real sicky, sweet, heavy filling. So I wanted to, you know, change all that and make the whoopie pie better.
One thing I want to ask you about the cake part, because when I ate one, first of all, we should say that they're a refrigerated product. So they're fresh, and they're so moist. The cake part is so moist, and they almost have the shape of like a muffin top. Are there special whoopie pie molds where you make that particular shape?
Actually, no. What we do is when we very first started out, it was an ice cream scoop. An ice cream scoop is like the best tool. Whoever invented it, I love you. And my secret is I use cake flour. I just really love cake flour to keep it, you know, a little moist. But because the batter itself is a little denser, it doesn't like just flatten out on the cookie sheet. When we use the ice cream scoop, that's what keeps them nice and round. They resemble the size of a hamburger.
Yeah, they're huge. Because I imagine them to be like maybe a little bigger than an Oreo. But in fact, they're like as big as your head. Now, what's the difference for some people who are used to different regional foods like moon pies and tasty cakes? How would you tell them the difference of a whoopie pie?
A lot of people do say that the whoopie pie is close to a moon pie, but the whoopie pie is really two round pieces of cake with the filling in the middle. I think that would be closer to maybe a Susie Q. The filling is vegetable, like a shortening. It has confectionate sugar, marshmallow, vanilla, and it's just whipped. We whip the crap out of it to make it really nice and fluffy. It's not good for you. We just tell everybody, you know, to eat one and go for a walk. Because unfortunately, those special treats, they're just not all good for you. But you have to reward yourself once in a while.
Thank you so much, Amy. It's been really fun. And we really enjoyed our shipment of Wicked Whoopies.
Oh, well, thank you so much.
Amy Bouchard is the proprietor of Wicked Whoopies in Gardner, Maine. You can order these pies online at wickedwhoopies.com. There are some wickedly delicious whoopie pies made fresh right here in Brentwood at Susie Cakes. They're on San Vicente at Barrington. When the original expats landed in New England and set up colonies, they had to figure out what to eat. I've always been fascinated by the history of this time and what food was available. I'll be right back with an expert on the subject. That's next on Good Food. History is a window deep into ourselves as individuals. As members of an ethnic tradition, and also with regard to this conversation, as part of a larger family called the United States of America. People now refer to our federation as a fast food nation. Is it anything at all that Jefferson would recognize? Sandy Oliver is a noted culinary historian. She's the author of Saltwater Foodways and Food in Colonial and Federal America. So when we're talking about federal America, what are we talking about?
We're talking about the first roughly 50 years after we become a nation, which we did in 1776.
And would Jefferson recognize us at all?
Oh, yes, he would. He would. There'd be some things missing.
Yeah. What would be missing?
Well, you know, one of the things that we have given up eating that a great many of our ethnic newcomers have not given up yet is offal.
Now, what is offal?
Liver, heart, kidneys, all the spare parts, you know. And you go into the markets, even here, just in the last couple of days when I've been in Los Angeles, I've seen all sorts of things that our forebears would have known what to do with in the ethnic markets.
Before I can even get a sense of what people eat, I need to get a sense of what the kitchens looked like. Was there something we would recognize as a stove?
In some houses, yes. A great many houses merely had a wide open fireplace with a lovely hearth on it, a crane, which is a bracket that came out from the side, from which pots would be hung on hooks. And a lot of the cooking was down hearth. Cooks took bundles of coals and made little burners and set the pots on top of those.
Now, what kind of food are we talking about? Give us a typical idea of dishes. What were the vegetables and how were they prepared?
The vegetables were seasonal. Surprise, surprise. Excepting, of course, pickles. People had pickles and put food away just as some of us do now. If you were well off and you could afford it, you would have asparagus in the spring and green peas as soon as they were available.
In terms of eating these foods, I would imagine that the elite, the gentry, they had potagers, they had big vegetable gardens. Mm-hmm. But what about the middle class? Did they buy from markets or did everyone have a plot and sort of was their table a reflection of what they grew themselves?
In the country, definitely people had gardens and they grew an awful lot of what they had. The things that they had to buy in, of course, were the imports of spices and coffee, tea, things of that sort. In the cities, everybody had to turn to the market. It wasn't unusual at all to sally forth in the morning with your basket, just like going to the farmer's market today.
And what about parties? With the elite, was a party done the same way it is now? Were there appetizers?
No. People sat down to a really grand meal with two or three courses. And the first course might include a roast of meat as well as a boiled joint of meat. And then there would be the side vegetables with potatoes prepared one way or another, or sweet potatoes, and then the green vegetables, a few pickle things. There was always bread.
And was most of the bread still whole grain bread?
No, no. We stopped eating whole grain bread as fast as we could. If you were well off, you wanted white bread. You sifted out all that darn bran, you know. If you were less well off, you had to eat bread that was made of mixtures of in New England, rye and cornmeal. If you were lucky, you had a little extra wheat you could mix in with it, but it was a brown bread. You know, this whole business of multi-grain bread, if you, you know, people from the past coming along would say, well, can't you do better than that?
What about a sweet tooth? Was sugar abundant? And what passed as dessert?
What passes for dessert are a lot of the usual suspects, you know, pies and open-faced tart sorts of things with boiled puddings.
And when you say boiled puddings, are they things that we would recognize today as bread puddings, or are they more like custardy, like chocolate puddings?
Alas, no chocolate. Chocolate was a beverage. But bread puddings, rice puddings, dumplings of various sorts. You roll out pastry, put a little apple inside, wrap the dough all around it, and boil it in a cloth. And then when you open it out, bang, there's this beautiful little apple, you know, put a little sugar and butter on it.
Oh, gosh,
cream,
that sounds
yum.
Fabulous.
Isn't it good?
It's just really good.
Yes.
Now, what about the native foods? As we became a federation and the middle class started to rise, were there any indigenous foods that just were completely embraced by everyone and became ours?
Corn. You know,
the bane of our existence today.
The bane of our existence today, but it was the absolute staff of life for so many people from colonial times right up to as it is into the present.
Now, what about the way we eat now, this habit of eating sort of on the fly, in our cars, as we're walking? Did this have its genesis way back then?
Oh, you bet. We've been speeding up for about 200 years. You know, it's a funny thing. European travelers to America, especially during this federal period when we're coming into existence, people came to America and they traveled around and observed Americans. They wanted to see what were Americans like. One of the things they observed was how quickly we ate. Men in big dining halls ate silently, wolfing their food down and then slamming out of the place as fast as they were done. One fellow came to this country and said, "The American knows the value of his time too well to spend it lingering at the table."
Was this because we were on a mission? I mean, everybody was...
We were on a make. Yep. We were on the make, you bet. We wanted to make money. That's you don't do that sitting around a table, you know.
Now, Sandy, I know that you have a special newsletter in addition to everything else you do. Tell me a little bit about it.
Food History News is a quarterly 10-page newsletter with no advertising dedicated to about 400 years of American food history.
Oh, it's wonderful. Thank you so much for existing.
Oh, thank you, Evan. How lovely.
It's been a pleasure. Food History News is the publication that Sandy Oliver edits and publishes. Find out more online at kcrw.com/goodfood. You know, sometimes we at Good Food can get it wrong. Last week, I talked with Sang Yoon, owner of Father's Office Bar in Santa Monica, about how winemakers often doctor their wines in order to produce consistent flavor. Winemakers don't publicize this process and don't mention the additives on their labels. We got an email this week from Jim Edelman, the general manager of Aubin Climat Winery, who's a fan of the show. He pointed out a few factual errors, so in order to get it right, we've asked Jim to be on this week to tell us the way it is. That's in 1 minute, right here on Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. Last week, we had chef and bar owner Sang Yoon on the show talking about additives that are commonly added into wine to enhance their flavor. But we got a few facts wrong. Jim Edelman is the general manager of Au Bon Climat and Cupé Wineries. He emailed us about our mistakes, so we've asked him to come on and clarify some misconceptions that we spread around last week. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Evan.
We said last week that wines from North America have more additives than those from the Old World. Is this true?
I really don't think so. I think it's a winery-to-winery sort of a thing. The wineries that I am familiar with, obviously Au Bon Climat and Cupé, the labels produced here, but also my neighboring wineries around Santa Barbara County, don't really add a lot of additives. There are larger wineries in the Central Valley, in France, Argentina, Chile, New Zealand, Australia, that do add a lot of additives. So I really think it's a winemaker kind of decision to make, and I don't think you can paint any region with that big broad brush about additives and how much are added to the wines.
Is it based on the quality of the grape, and is that a regional problem, or does it vary year to year?
Well, it's both of those things. If you have a poor harvest, like let's say, for example, we had a lot of rain in 1994, and so we had to add different things to a wine from that vintage than we would from, let's say, a vintage like 2005, where Mother Nature gave us absolutely perfect grapes. You know, it is a biological reaction making wine, and Mother Nature controls so much of the process, not only the grape growing part, but the fermentation process as well.
So when you did have problems in 94 and you did have to add things, what kind of things were you adding and why?
In 1994, there was rain on the grapes, and so we had a little bit more of a rot problem in the grapes. And so we'd have to add a little bit more of a clay, it's bentonite, that has an affinity for the protein in the wine. And in order to help the wine become stable, we added this bentonite clay into the wine. And of course, Evan, then it falls completely to the bottom of the tank, and the amount of clay that is actually seen in a finished wine is insignificant.
Does the clay also act as a clarifying agent?
It does. That was one of the things that he was talking about last week, where he's talking about clarifying of wines. It's a hard thing to really visualize when you're not a winemaker, but there are things in wines that are there and are very hard to get to fall out of the wine to clarify. The only way you can really clarify a wine the best way is over time. You just have gravity taking effect and pulling these things to the bottom of the barrel.
Another fact that we seem to have gotten wrong was about flakes that show up in wine. What are those?
Well, he mentioned that the flakes in the bottom of the wine were tartaric acid, and it made it seem like during the course of the interview that we were adding so much acid to wines that it wasn't even going into solution any longer, and it was precipitating to the bottom. What happens is during the winemaking process, there is tartaric acid in the grapes, and when the fermentation is completed, the solubility for tartaric acid is less with alcohol in the solution, and there is a natural process of tartaric acid, calcium tartrate actually, that goes through this phenomenon of calcium binding to tartrate and precipitating out and looking like flakes, or some people even call them wine diamonds, where there are little crystals in there.
So what are the most common winemaking tricks, as you call them, that go on?
Well, one of the ones that I just wanted to address, and during the course of the interview, you talked about animal proteins. And we do add egg whites to wine. In fact, here, Jim Clendenin, who owns Au Bon Climat, has a ranch with a number of chickens, and we'll actually add egg whites to the barrels. And it's generally with red wines. Red wines have more tannin. Tannin is the part of the wine that is kind of drying or bitter. And in order to make a wine more balanced and maybe go with food a little bit better, we take a little bit of that tannin out. And the egg white has an affinity for excess tannin. The egg white sinks to the bottom of the barrel, and there it stays, and the clear wine is taken off the top. And once again, there's probably an insignificant amount of that animal protein or egg white actually seen in the bottled product.
Are tricks like this ancient tricks? Have people been doing this since Roman times, or are these relatively new ways of changing structure of wine?
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because something like an egg white addition has been used for many, many, many years, once again, because people realized that young wines were harsh and they wanted a way to make them more drinkable at an early age. And so a lot of these things have been used for centuries, and we've just adapted them to a more modern situation here.
Thank you so much, Jim. We really are very happy that you emailed us, and it was great to be able to get you on so quickly to address our mistakes.
Well, thank you for having me on.
To listen to last week's interview on additives, check us out online at kcrw.com/goodfood. Jim Edelman is the general manager of Au Bon Climat Winery. If you have an issue with our show, please send us a note to goodfood@kcrw.com. Sometimes things are not what they seem, and that couldn't be more true than in the movies. I'll be back with a film food stylist who's figured out how to make realistic-looking items edible. That's next on Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. Do you ever wonder if that dinner an actor tucks into during a scene tastes good? Bonnie Belknap owns Gourmet Proppers, a business that specializes in edible camera-ready food. Hi.
Hi.
Now, what are some of the applications? I mean, to us, what immediately comes to mind is food that's actually eaten by actors during, like, a dinner scene.
Mm-hmm.
But it goes way beyond that, doesn't it?
It can be very specific, something that's a tight shot, like with the actors eating in a dinner scene or something. Or a lot of times, the food that we do helps to sell or to convey a look or a theme or develop a character.
Right before we started talking on air, you mentioned that you actually had to create some foods that were oversized for a commercial. Could you describe that?
That was for a Nike commercial, and it was with LeBron James. And you can imagine the size of his hands. They're enormous. And the scene was he was around a kitchen table eating different meals, and the rest of the people around the table had regular, normal-sized food. But LeBron was so big that the food looked like miniature food, so we had to oversize everything. And for breakfast, he was eating Cheerios. So we had to fabricate Cheerios that were 3, 4, 5 times the size of regular Cheerios. And that was trial and error, getting them the exact color and texture. And we had to make 2,000 of those. For the dinner scene, they were eating spaghetti and meatballs, and his meatballs were 1-pound meatballs. You know, a dinner roll on the set, they decided the last minute, we want some dinner rolls that are bigger. Well, I had nothing there. There was no stove, no nothing. Someone ran to the store and got some yeast and some flour and some, you know, I had some water on the set, and I found an old coffee can, emptied it out and used that, mixed it up, let it rise underneath, you know, a heat lamp that was there on the set, and then found somebody a couple stages away that had a stove, and I threw it in the oven there, and that's how I made a huge oversized dinner roll.
So interesting. Sometimes we'll see a scene where, for example, with gangsters, some gangster will take a cigarette and jam it down somebody's throat. You can't imagine an actor wanting to consume that.
No, and we did that on CSI New York. They needed something just like that. So we found soy paper, and then I toasted coconut and got that the exact color of the tobacco and rolled it up and then had edible ink to write like whatever it was, a Marlboro on the end, I can't remember, and they looked exactly like cigarettes.
What was one of the most difficult and enormous challenges that you faced creating something with food?
The most enormous, even though it's been quite a few years, was working on Hook with Spielberg. One scene in particular was for The Lost Boys, and it was a fantasy scene. And I'll remember to this day and probably forever, Mr. Spielberg grabbing my arm and walking with me and saying that he wanted food that no one had ever seen before, you know, fantasy food. And he'd look at me and say, so you didn't know what I mean? Everything had to be edible. He wanted the kids to be able to go, and whatever they grabbed, he wanted them to be able to eat.
So it was like an edible forest, if
yes,
I remember.
Yes. And so there was a tree that we made that was 4 or 5 feet tall that was out of dough, bread dough, so they could go break a branch off and eat the dough. There was a rock quarry in one corner. It was all made out of boulders and lizards and snakes. All of that was edible, you know, out of pulled sugar and whatnot.
Have you ever had a total and complete fiasco?
There's often. But, you know, you're doing it long enough, you always anticipate for what we do, too. If there's a scene and someone's eating something for dinner, you have 8 to 10 backups of what they're going to take a bite out of, you know, just for that reason, too.
What about, like, I understand once for Dragnet, you had to do an enormous seafood buffet with a giant ice sculpture. Do you contract out everything, or do you have an enormous culinary warehouse where you have chefs toiling away making sculptures?
I have a lot of people that I can call upon that have worked for me over the years that do various things. I have an artist that carves things out of ice and fruits and vegetables. It's just amazing. But when you do have an ice carving, I mean, you can imagine with the heat and the lights, you always need to have 3 or 4 of those. In that Dragnet movie, there were explosives that were literally planted in all the food, in the pate, in the seafood, in all of the desserts, so that when the gangsters came through with the, you know, with their machines and they blew everything up, all the food exploded. And of course, they saved that for the last shot of the day. It was a mess.
Really, really incredible. What's the strangest food creation you ever had to make?
Well, one that comes to mind was on Las Vegas. And the story was that the host of the Fear Factor show, I can't recall his name right now, but he was playing himself and he was a guest at the hotel. And all the girls were vying for his attention. And Nikki Cox thought she would win him out by eating some, you know, ghoulish things. So the people from Fear Factor actually brought me a cooler of items that I was supposed to replicate into something that Nikki would eat. Pig rectum, intestine. I can't remember the other. Those stick with me.
How did you make the pig rectums?
Oh, it was disgusting. Well, I ended up, I don't know if you've ever seen
a pig rectum. I can only imagine.
And I don't want to say it looks just like chicken, but I took a chicken breast and hammered it out with like a meat tenderizer, you know, the kind that puts all the little holes in it and stuff. So it almost got transparent. And that's sort of the texture that the rectum was. And to keep the color, I poached the chicken so it stayed very light. And then I did it in a very light cream sauce. I mean, it was pretty disgusting, but it tasted delicious. She loved it. And it looked just like it. And for the intestines, we made oversized, like a tubular pasta, which looked like intestine too. So, you know, it's trial and error. You just learn as you go.
So interesting. Thanks a lot, Bonnie. It was so much fun talking
to
you.
Oh, you're welcome.
Gourmet Proppers is Bonnie Belknap's company. They specialize in edible props for the film and TV industry. Next, a look at some of the best and fine food products that we have access to in LA. That's when Good Food continues. I remember the days when you'd go to a grocery store and see, well, groceries, normal stuff. Gourmet shops had things like Kalamata olives and fancy mint jelly. Well, things have surely changed. Walk into any grocery store and there are tens of vinegars and olive oils, so many condiments you can barely focus your eyes. But then comes along a wonderful little store and eatery like Cube at Divine Pasta. And the focus is on ingredients that go way beyond that jar of mint jelly. With us this morning is Rachel Sheridan. She's the buyer of all these wonderful gourmet foods for Cube. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
So let's start with one of my favorite products, fennel pollen.
I love fennel pollen.
Now describe what it is.
Fennel pollen is just the pollen from wild fennel and the little seeds. Ours is from California. You can get it from Italy. I like it because it's a California product, it's local, and it's in a little tin. It's a bit cheaper than the one you can get from Italy.
Yeah, I actually have started, every time I go to Italy, I bring home literally 5 pounds of fennel pollen. And what's amazing is you look at it and you think there's people out there collecting pollen.
Mm-hmm.
What a labor-intensive job.
So labor-intensive, and it just grows wild, and they're out on the side of this road basically just collecting
this
stuff.
Yeah, anybody who drives down Laurel Canyon, any of the canyons, or if you're on the Palisades, you just see all this wild fennel everywhere.
Everywhere, and it's free food, basically. I mean, you could totally stop and make like a killer risotto, and you don't even know. You think it's a weed.
It is a weed, and we should say that wild fennel is very different than domesticated fennel because it's not about the bulb.
No, it's about the fronds.
It's about the fronds.
Totally,
yeah.
Totally.
Can you try and describe this flavor? It's sort of this elusive flavor and how it's different than domesticated fennel.
To me, it smells like a mix between celery, anise, and fennel. I mean, that's what it really – everyone comes up with something different. It's got a honey overtone to it.
It's really – it's like the most perfect of all of the, quote, licorice flavor.
Yeah, because it's not too strong. You don't need a lot of it.
What do you use it for at Cube?
We make an amazing wild fennel ragu with sausage and then put some of that in it.
Wonderful.
Really good with gnocchi. I love it just with sautéed sugar snap peas. You just sprinkle a little on. I mean, it really is anytime you're making something and you just think, you know how sometimes you make something and you're like,
it needs something.
What does this need? And maybe it's vinegar or maybe it's fennel pollen. Yams, I think it would be really good on.
Ooh,
like a yam
gratin.
That's
such a great idea. See, I think so traditionally. The thing we've used it for years at Angeli is our arista, our pork loin roast.
Nice, nice.
Yeah, really good.
Oh, really good, yeah.
So sitting in front of me, I have all these products to look at. Mm-hmm. And there's one here that I really, really love. I mean, most people here, even very sophisticated eaters, have no idea what chicherchie are.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Now, describe them.
Well, they look like rocks, basically.
Or little teeth.
Little teeth. Yeah, when you soak them, they look like yellow teeth. They're very disconcerting at first. You're just kind of like, I'm going to eat that. Mm, wonderful yellow teeth. But they're an ancient form of chickpea. And I guess they've been cultivated since Roman times. Noblemen used to eat them. They're protected by slow food now. They've kind of put them on their, what is that, the Presidio? And they've protected them. I love them. I mean, you can braise them. We use them at Cube. We do a lemon roasted chicken with those and artichokes and fava beans right now. They don't get mushy for me. They always kind of hold their texture.
Yeah, they're very toothsome.
Yeah, they're very toothsome. And they're just fun. They're beautiful on a plate. They're so pretty and rustic looking.
I'm just going to pick up something else. These are these beautiful little discs that look like communion wafers.
Yeah.
But in fact, they are corazzetti.
Pasta. They're from feudal times, and what the lords and noblemen used to do was put their crest on. So if you visited at dinner time, they were still letting you know who was boss and where you were. They're perfect with pesto, and right now, I mean, it's so pretty on a plate with maybe grilled fish or something.
The thing I love about this particular shape of pasta is it really does lend itself to sort of the American way of serving pasta as a side instead of as a separate plate.
Yeah, you don't have to have a lot of it. It's very hearty. I mean, you look at them and you don't think that they're going to be much.
No, they're quite chewy.
They're chewy and they're really filling.
Now, this is something I've never seen before. This is a tomato vinegar?
This is one of my most favorite products. It's actually a winemaker from Alto Adige and a vinegar maker from Germany. And what they do is it's not an infusion. Any of the vinegars they make, so this is tomato, so they make tomato wine, and then they put it through the vinification process. So when you taste this, I mean, it's amazing. They have a fig. They have a blueberry.
So this must be, just with a tomato salad in the summer, must be amazing.
Exactly. Like for me right now, I mean, you go to the farmer's market now and you see all these hothouse tomatoes and it's kind of a tease because they look wonderful and then you get them and you're like, oh, they're still not that great. But if you get a tomato salad right now and you put some of that on, you will be dying for summer to come.
Now, what are those little beans by your elbow? They look beautiful.
These are runner,
beautiful.
Aren't they great? They're runner cannellinis, and they're from Rancho Gordo. He's up in Napa. He's the coolest guy. His name's Steve Sando. And
these look a little different than regular. They're sort of like cannellini on steroids.
They are. They're kind of like, they almost look like they're Corona beans' cousin. Like they're littler, and they get even bigger when you, they triple almost when you cook them. But they're amazing. And this guy, he's saving all these heirloom beans. When you soak these, they taste like a fresh bean.
Wow.
It's amazing. You know how sometimes you soak beans and it's just like, blech. But these will taste like a fresh bean and they're really great.
Now, you have one bottle of olive oil with you, and I'm always interested to learn about yet one more fabulous oil. Where is this one from?
It's from Molise, actually, which is, you know, a little region, not very well known, Parco di Bouille. It's a really light olive oil. It's great for spring. It's a finishing oil. I mean, you wouldn't obviously cook with it, but on your vegetables, on fish, on chicken, it's a really nice oil. He actually only produced 3,400 liters of that, and he numbers them all by hand. You can see at the bottom. Yeah.
So incredible.
Yeah.
Well, Rachel, this has been so much fun
talking with you. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Oh, it's our pleasure. Rachel Sheridan's the food buyer at Cube, located at 615 North La Brea. Cube has a great series coming up called Maker Nights on May 3rd and 4th. You can meet the artisans who make some of the finest products available, including Armandino Batali from Seattle's Salumi Artisan Cured Meats. The makers of Georgia's Sweet Grass Dairy will be there too. For reservations, call Cube at 323-939-1148 or go online at kcrw.com/goodfood. Everyone's talking about going green. One way to do your part is to compost your food scraps. How to start? And what about worms? I'll be back with the king of compost. That's next on Good Food. One day several years ago, I contemplated my browning lawn, which was slowly dying from lack of water during one of our fabulous drought cycles. I thought to myself, if I just get rid of it, then I can have a lovely pastoral garden in the front yard. So I sheet composted the front lawn. For weeks, I dragged garbage home from the restaurant, waited until the middle of the night, tore up a few feet of lawn, then layered it with garbage and straw and a drizzle of water. Slowly, my soil went from clay so thick I could make pots from it to a more crumbly clay with little volunteer worms crawling through it. Now, I don't recommend this dramatic project to you, and my pastoral image of my front yard still hasn't come to pass, but composting is a truly fabulous, life-changing experience for anyone raised in the city. Dr. Keith Thompson is program director from the Smart Gardening Program of the Department of Public Works, and he's with us today to fill us in on the details of composting. Does the city want people to compost at their homes?
Well, it's the city and the county. The program I run is the Los Angeles County Department of Public Works Smart Gardening Program. We cooperate with all 88 jurisdictions in the county to encourage all residents to divert a wide variety of organic wastes from being disposed via the trash to being managed very effectively and efficiently through composting techniques so that you can reuse those nutrients to help build your soil, save water, and ultimately conserve natural resources.
Can anybody living in Southern California compost even if you live in an apartment?
Sure. It requires a little more effort if you live in an apartment. For apartments and condominium dwellers, the challenge really becomes one of, since you don't generate a lot of green material from lawns and shrubs and things like that, you're really looking at trying to find ways to compost the food waste and perhaps some clippings, prunings from houseplants and things like that. There's a method of composting called worm composting or vermicomposting that's ideally suited for apartment dwellers and condo dwellers. The bins are very small, self-contained. The worms do all of the real heavy lifting and heavy work. And the real advantage to worm composting is the worm compost that you can harvest at the end of the process makes a tremendous potting soil mixture so that you can transplant and grow just about any kind of plant you'd care to take a stab at.
Okay, worm composting. This really intrigues me because basically you're talking about making a worm farm.
Yes. And the difference between the worms you see in your backyard that are in your yard and garden, those are a different type of worm. They prefer to actually live down in deep in the soil, and they move material from the surface down through the soil column. Very good, very useful. The kinds of worms that you use in a worm composting bin are what are called litter layer worms. They usually come from tropical and semi-tropical litter forests where they live in the decaying organic debris that collects at the bottom of trees and plants and things like that. So they're ideally suited for living in small worm bins. They like to live in a layer of material that's 6 to 9 inches deep that consists primarily of organic material that's in varying states of decomposition. The worms are very active feeders, so they can cycle that organic material very quickly. Because they live in a confined box and are less likely to get wanderlust and start going all over the place, they will cohabitate with you in your condo quite nicely inside their little worm farms.
Now, is there an odor that the worm compost bin gives off while it's working?
No. Done properly, neither backyard composting nor worm composting will produce offensive odors. When you get odors, it's usually an indication that something is going wrong or you've added something that you shouldn't. In the case of a worm composting bin, what you're focusing on is primarily vegetative and fruit materials, the same kinds of things we eat. Worms enjoy a nice balanced diet, so not a lot of any one thing, but a little of everything. And the aroma of decay is actually, if anything, it's got a slightly sweet smell that would be normal to fruit and vegetable material.
When I want to sort of harvest my compost that's been completed, do I have to reach into the bin, which is filled of wriggling worms, and separate it out?
Well, you can do the harvesting a number of ways. The easiest way is to do what we call end feeding. That is, you start feeding one end of the bin exclusively for a couple of weeks. Worms, because they're opportunistic feeders, will tend to migrate down where the food's at. At that point, you can then harvest between 25% to maybe a third of the volume of worm compost that's collected on the other end. Now, you'll want to go through that and pick out any obvious worms, but the vast majority of them will be down at the other end, so it's pretty easy to do.
Is worm composting easier than bin composting?
Yes and no. Worm composting has the advantage that you can take care of your worms much like you take care of yourself. The same kinds of fruits and vegetables that you would enjoy, the worms will enjoy. Now, worms are herbivores. They only eat vegetative material. You don't want to feed them meats, cheeses, dairy, things like that. But pretty much anything you eat, worms can eat. An outside bin requires a bit more effort to do, but it has the advantage of being able to compost effectively a much larger amount of material and a much more diverse array of material in a backyard bin. So the purposes that are served by the two kinds of composting are somewhat different, but there's an ideal way for anyone.
Thank you so much, Keith. It's been really, really fun. Now, we should say that you do give a lot of workshops all over Southern California. Where's the best place for people to find out information about time and place that would be good for them?
Sure. The easiest place is to go to the county's website, www.smartgardening.com. You can also call the county's hotline number, 1-888-CLEAN-LA.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks for asking me in.
That was Dr. Keith Thompson, Smart Gardening Program Director of the Department of Public Works. I'll have a video podcast up next month on how to compost. In the meantime, you can watch our latest good food video on artichokes at kcrw.com/goodfood or on iTunes. Good Food's executive producer is Jennifer Farrow. The show is produced by Thea Schalliner with Bob Carlson, Candace Moyer, Connie Alvarez, and Holly Tarson. Music supervisor is Gary Messiha. And special thanks to Beth Xavier. I'm Evan Kleiman. Join us next week for another edition of Good Food.